Chapter 14. The Unacceptable Face of Communism. When I went forth from home into the homeless life on the 18th of August 1947, it was with the intention of renouncing the world in the fullest and most literal sense. For me, pravajya, or going forth, meant giving up family ties, social position, and national and racial identity, as well as mundane interests and activities of every kind. It meant giving up pleasure and possessions, and whatever else might serve to aggrandize the ego or enhance the sense of separate selfhood. The only thing from which I did not go forth that day, not because I refused to go forth from it, but because the idea of so doing did not occur to me, was my mother tongue, English, to which I was in fact, unconsciously, quite attached. Since then it had been borne in upon me that it was less easy to achieve a full and literal renunciation of the world than I, in my youthful enthusiasm, had imagined, and that the reasons for this were not merely subjective, but also solidly objective. Because I had no identity papers and refused to declare my nationality, saying that as a renunciant I had none, I had not been allowed to enter Buddhist Ceylon, and because I had no money, as I was trying to observe the precept of not handling gold and silver, I had been refused ordination by the time-serving Theravadin monks of Sarnath. Eventually, I had been obliged to make concessions. In Kalimpong, I admitted to being English, though without going into details, and not only handled gold and silver in the form of specie and banknotes, but engaged in at least some of the transactions of which this was an inseparable part. But concessions were one thing, abandonment of principle quite another. Believing as I did that going forth was of the essence of the spiritual life, I tried not to think of myself as an Englishman, did my best not to utilize whatever money came my way for the gratification of personal desires, and abstained as much as I could from mundane interests and activities. Thus, I abstained from reading newspapers and from discussing politics, though at times it was difficult for me to stop my ears against Joe's violent denunciation of all the works and ways of Prime Minister Winston Churchill and President Dwight Eisenhower, or even to refrain from questioning some of his wilder assertions. Largely because I did not read the newspapers, I had little sense of what was going on in the wider world, or even in India. I lived for meditation and study, for my students, and for the work for the good of Buddhism that my teacher, Kashyapji, before his departure from Kalimpong, had enjoined upon me. Nevertheless, I was vaguely aware of vast events looming on the horizon. I was aware that in the West, World War II had been succeeded by the Cold War between the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe on the one hand, and the United States and Western Europe on the other, and that in the East, Tibet had been occupied by the forces of Communist China and its religion and culture ruthlessly suppressed. I was aware that the aim of Marxian communism was world domination. Unlike many others of my generation, I had no sympathy with communism, either as a philosophy or as a program for social change, and no sympathy with its adherents as such. Why this should have been so, I find it difficult to say. My lack of sympathy was instinctive rather than being the reasoned result of study and reflection. It was as though I sensed in communism a threat to everything I held most dear, whether in the realm of ideas, the field of poetry and the fine arts, or the domain of ethics and spiritual life. Communism was the negation of truth, of beauty, of goodness. Not that I knew very much about Marxian communism, factually speaking. As a 15-year-old evacuee in Barnstable during the war, I had read Das Kapital. Why I read it, I do not know, except that in those days I read everything on which I could lay my hands. But for me there was no Marxist equivalent of a Road to Damascus experience, and I was not converted to the faith. A year or two later, having returned home towards the end of the Blitz, I discovered a left-wing bookshop near Tooting Broadway. Probably it was the only bookshop in the whole of southwest London, and after a certain amount of hesitation, bought and read Lenin's The State and Revolution, which was more interesting than Das Kapital, as well as being much shorter. At about the same time, one of my colleagues at County Hall, where I was working, lent me a copy of David Guest's Dialectical Materialism. This colleague was himself a communist, but if he had expected David Guest to succeed where Marx and Lenin had failed, he was disappointed, and I remained unconverted. When I returned the book to him, it was with the remark that, in my opinion, it was not Hegel, in whom I was then deep, who was standing on his head, as the author alleged, but Marx, it being axiomatic for Marxist thought that Marx had found Hegel upside down and had restored him to his feet, that is, had given his idealism a materialist interpretation. Not long afterwards, my colleague received his calling-up papers, and our discussions came to an end. Before the time came for my own induction into the armed forces, he was back in the department and doing his old job, minus both legs and on crutches. The war was inflicting its terrible casualties in both Europe and the Far East, and on service personnel and civilians alike. During those days, I did read the newspapers, as well as listen to the wireless, as many people still called the radio. And though the full horror of what was happening was sometimes concealed from us, we were aware that what was happening was dreadful beyond imagination. In particular, we were aware, in the winter of 1942 to 1943, of the long-drawn-out battle for Stalingrad, and of the sufferings of the Russian people, as they endured, then resisted, and finally routed the forces of invading Nazi Germany. With others in Britain, I rejoiced at their victory and mourned their great losses. Nor could I hear the soulful, not to say sentimental, popular ballad Russian Rose, as I think it was called, with its promise of new life for the heroic Russian people, without the tears coming into my eyes and a lump rising in my throat. It was the Russian people who were victorious, not the communists. Russia was not Trotsky and Lenin, Stalin and Beria. Russia was Pushkin, Lermontov, Gogol, Turgenev, Chekhov, Tolstoy, and Dostoevsky. In the very month that I had read Das Kapital, I had also read The Brothers Karamazov, and there was no doubt which of them had made the deeper impression on me. It was the same in the case of China. To me, it was not the Chinese people who had invaded Tibet, so much as the Chinese Red Army. China was not Mao Zedong and the Little Red Book. China was Confucius and Lao Tzu, Wei Lang and Chiai, Li Taipo and Tu Fu, as well as the great painters of landscapes and of flowers. I therefore felt for China and the Chinese people the same love that I felt for Russia and the Russian people, so that when, towards the end of February, the two young Nepalese organisers came with an invitation to speak at the inaugural meeting of the Kalimpong branch of the Indo-Chinese Friendship Society, I was happy to accept, the more especially as the meeting was to be held under the presidentship of Anandji. Not that I accepted without having ascertained the exact nature of the gathering. Relations between democratic India and totalitarian China were then at their most cordial. On all sides, the mantra Hindi, Chini, bye bye, or Indians and Chinese are brothers, could be heard. In these circumstances, it was unlikely that a body whose objective was the promotion of friendship between the two Asian giants would not have at least a quasi-political agenda, and neither as a Buddhist monk nor as a foreign national residing in a sensitive border area did I wish to get involved in politics. I could take part in the meeting, I therefore informed the two young men, only if it was completely non-political. This would certainly be the case, they both hastened to assure me. The meeting was to be a purely cultural affair, without the least trace of politics. And Anandji, when I met him a few days later, gave me a similar assurance. The afternoon of the first Sunday in March, accordingly, saw me leaving Craigside for the town hall soon after lunch. I did not really need to leave so early, but knowing Anandji's dilatory, dawdling ways, It was my intention to call for him en route and make sure he was not late for the meeting. On entering the upstairs room he occupied at the Dharmodya Vihara, I found he was not alone. With him was Aaron Kharki, one of the young men who had invited me to speak at the inaugural meeting. This itself was not surprising. What was surprising was that the two of them were engaged in finalising the wording of some 36 resolutions, and that these resolutions, which were to be passed at the meeting, were each and every one of them strongly condemnatory of the policies and actions of the United States in this or that part of the world. As I walked down the road, I experienced a variety of emotions. I was annoyed that the young organisers should have attempted to gain my support for their society by deliberately misleading me as to its true nature, and annoyed that Anandji should apparently have seconded them in the attempt. At the same time, I was relieved that their machinations had not succeeded, for had I spoken at the meeting, no doubt before the resolutions were read out, I would have been placed in a very awkward, indeed quite false, position. To have supported the resolutions, if only by my silence, would have given the impression that I was anti-American and pro-communist, while to have objected to them would have given the impression that I was pro-American and anti-communist. In either case, I would have become involved in politics, or at least have appeared to become involved in them, which in a place like Kalimpong amounted to much the same thing. My predominant emotion, however, as I made my way back to Craigside that afternoon, was one of satisfaction, almost of elation. I was glad I had not yielded to Anandji's pleas not to leave him in the lurch, or accepted his absurd suggestion that, as a compromise, I should sit with him on the platform, but not actually speak. The knowledge that I had done what I believed to be right, regardless of possible untoward consequences, indeed had the effect of giving me an increased sense of energy and purpose. It was as though my refusal to take part in the inaugural meeting, after discovering its true nature, constituted an affirmation of my status as a moral agent, and of the fact that, in the last analysis, and irrespective of circumstances, the responsibility for my life and actions was mine and mine alone. What explanation Anandji gave for my absence from the meeting I never really knew. According to one account, he said I was unwell. According to another, he joked about my having changed my mind at the last minute, for unexplained reasons no doubt connected with the poetic temperament. Whatever he may have said, the fact that I had not attended the meeting was the subject of a good deal of comment and speculation in the town, especially as I had been billed as the principal speaker. So much was this the case that I decided, a few days afterwards, to make my position clear. What better way was there of doing this than through the medium of the local press? The press existed, after all, to keep its readers informed about matters of public interest. I accordingly wrote a letter to the Himalayan Times, the town's English-language weekly newspaper, describing exactly what had happened, and dispatched it to the editor with a covering note, requesting him to publish it as soon as possible. He did not publish it either that week or any other. If my experience with the Indo-Chinese Friendship Society gave me a glimpse of the unacceptable face of communism, not that there was necessarily an acceptable face behind the unacceptable one, then my experience with the Himalayan Times gave me a glimpse of the unacceptable face of the press. As was to be increasingly borne in upon me in the years to come, newspapers and magazines, no less than communist front organisations, had their own agendas, and the dissemination of truth did not always feature among them. Perhaps it was a measure of the extent to which I had gone forth from the world and its ways, a measure of my ignorance of real life, Joe would have said, that it had not occurred to me that the organisers of a public meeting might want to mislead and deceive me, or that the editor of a local newspaper might be unwilling to give space to a statement of the facts on a matter of public interest, especially when that statement clarified a confusion. My refusal to speak at the inaugural meeting of the Indo-Chinese Friendship Society, or even to support Anand G. with my silent presence on the platform, made no difference to my relations with my opportunistic elder brethren in the order, as I knew would be the case. There was little that he did not regard with good-humoured cynicism, least of all the objections and reservations of his eccentric, over-idealistic young friend, who, he was convinced, to the extent that he could be convinced of anything, was inclined to take his Buddhism far too seriously, and to be much too rigid in his attitude towards such things as bending the truth a little in the interests of a good cause. A glimpse of just how cynical Anand G. really was had been vouchsafed me only a few weeks earlier. Happening to call at Craigside one morning, and having entered my room without my noticing, he had looked over my shoulder to see what I was writing. I must have been working on the survey of Buddhism, for I had written at that very moment something about ethics, meditation and wisdom being the means to the realisation of nirvana. "Why are you wasting your time in that old-fashioned stuff?" a sneering, contemptuous voice behind me wanted to know. The unfeeling words pierced me to the quick. It was as though Mara himself had released a poisoned arrow from his bow. However, out of respect for RNG's seniority, I made no attempt to justify myself and welcomed the unexpected visitor in my usual fashion. His characterization of ethics, meditation and wisdom, the three great stages of the Buddhist spiritual path, as old-fashioned, was no momentary aberration. For him, old-fashioned meant not to be taken seriously, even as new, modern, up-to-date and advanced meant to be taken seriously, though not too seriously. As I already knew, Anand G. was at least as much a progressivist as he was a Buddhist. Or rather, he was a Buddhist only to the extent that Buddhism could be seen as progressive, that is, seen as a rationalistic, scientific and iconoclastic system that was in keeping with the times and in line with the latest contemporary thought. It was thus possible for him to give his support to a communist front organisation and even to help draft anti-American resolutions without feeling that this was in any way incompatible with his role as a Buddhist monk. At the same time, he was not so very much a communist as to actually want to identify himself with communism or to risk a breach with me on its account. For my own part, I considered it no business of mine to correct one who has spent more than 20 years in the robes, and in any case, Anand G. always treated me with so much friendliness and evaded my attempts to draw him into serious discussion with such an engaging mixture of adroitness and good humour that, notwithstanding our differences of temperament and outlook, I found it impossible to quarrel with him, or even to get him to acknowledge any real divergence of opinion between us. Our first meeting after the Sunday afternoon debacle therefore passed off quite amicably. Anand G. asked me to help him edit Lumbini, an English language magazine devoted to the Buddha's birthplace that Gyan Jyoti wanted to bring out, and I agreed to do so. We also discussed on this and several other occasions that month his and Gyan Jyoti's plans for an evening college at the Dharmojaya Vihara. Most of these discussions took place in Anand G's room. He was usually writing when I called, but occasionally I found him talking with a visitor or two, and an exchange that took place between him and a Nyuwa devotee served to open my eyes to another side of his character, though without making it any easier for me to comprehend him. In the vicinity of Tenth Mile, behind a row of open-fronted shops, stood half a dozen tumble-down wooden shacks. I knew these shacks well, having included them in my arms round in my early days in Kalimpong, when, first with Kashapji, then on my own, I had followed the time-honoured practice of relying for my one meal of the day on my begging bowl. They were inhabited by poor but devout Nyuas, and it was between Anand G. and one of these good folk, the supporter of a wife and 5 or 6 children, that the exchange in question took place. cap clasped respectfully to his chest with both hands. The newar, a grey-haired, shabbily dressed man of about 40, was kneeling in front of Arunji and regarding him with an expression of intense devotion. My elder brother in the order, for his part, sat on the edge of his bed and appeared to be contemplating one of his sandals, which was broken. For a while, nothing was said. Arunji then mused, as though speaking to himself, "Well, it's broken. I won't be able to wear these sandals again. But how will a poor bhikkhu like me get a new pair, I wonder?" Whereupon the fish swallowed the bait. "I'll get you a new pair, Bhante, if you permit me," breathed the devotee, his eyes shining. But Arunji was too experienced an angler to pull on the line straight away. "Well," he sighed, "it would be nice if somebody bought me a pair. Otherwise..." This was permission enough for his interlocutor, who, having made a triple prostration, left for the bazaar, returning half an hour later with a pair of sandals, which he then presented, with another triple prostration, to a smiling Arunji. I was shocked. The sandals must have cost 12 rupees, and the newar, a silversmith who was nearly always out of work, did not make more than 45 or 50 rupees a month, whereas Arunji received a pension of 250 rupees a month from the Association for the Advancement of the National Language, whose general secretary he had been for many years. Having glimpsed the unacceptable face of communism and the unacceptable face of the press, was I now being vouchsafed a glimpse of the unacceptable face of Theravadin monasticism? But while shocked, again out of respect for Arunji's seniority, I said nothing, though I wondered for how much longer I would be able to remain silent. Arunji was not only a Buddhist, he was also a progressivist, and as such highly critical of any exploitation of the poor by the rich. Did he not realise that by representing himself as a poor bhikkhu, who did not know where his next pair of sandals was coming from, he was guilty of falsehood and guilty of taking advantage, moreover, of the faith of a poverty-stricken Buddhist layman? I myself, knowing the straitened circumstances of the Newar family, and did not even accept their invitations to bhojanadanas or ceremonial food offerings, which I somehow managed to do without hurting their feelings. Yet here was the comparatively wealthy Arunji angling for a pair of sandals, which, as he must have known, the donor could ill afford to give him. Had he, then, no heart, either as a Buddhist or as a progressivist? But if I said nothing about the incident to Arunji, I could not help unburdening myself to Naginda, who knew his preceptor a good deal better than I did. The young ex-untouchable had long since got over his resentment at the undue strictness, as he saw it, with which I treated him, and since his ordination had been to see me a number of times, usually in order to borrow money. Arunji was not exactly tight-fisted, he explained. It was not that he bought nothing that he could get another to buy for him, or that he never spent money on anyone. But his generosity was certainly selective. If you were one of his favourites, as Sumedha was, he could be very generous. But if you were not a member of that select band, as he himself was not, you got little or nothing. That was why he was always coming to me for money, Naginda added with a laugh. Arunji must have allowed the Newar to buy him the sandals so that he would have more money to spend on Sumedha, Gunakar and co, the second of whom, who was studying in Darjeeling, as I well knew, was costing Arunji quite a bit in college fees and pocket money. All the same, he agreed it was wrong of his preceptor to have manoeuvred the Newar into buying the sandals for him, especially when he had 2,000 rupees in his account with the Kalimpong branch of the central bank. How did he know this? Arunji had sent him to collect his passbook, and on the way back to the Vihara, he had taken a peep inside and seen the amount. Though Naginda's disclosure made Arunji's exchange with the Newar devotee seem even more shocking, I was as far as ever from comprehending my many-sided elder brother in the order. No doubt he was deceitful and manipulative, besides being a thorough cynic, and no doubt he did not scruple to exploit those who were less astute or more principled than he was himself. Yet he also possessed many admirable qualities. He was good-tempered, approachable, and without a trace of the arrogance and self-importance that characterized so many Theravadin bhikkhus. Moreover, he lived simply, without caring for fine robes or rich repasts, and he did not eat in the evening, though he always took a glass of hot milk before going to bed, which, strictly speaking, was against the Vinaya. Like me, but unlike the vast majority of our yellow-robed brethren in Ceylon, Burma, and Thailand, he was a vegetarian, probably as much because of early cultural conditioning he had been born into a Brahmin family as out of religious conviction. A progressive journalist rather than a writer on Buddhism, he had contributed to the revival of Buddhism in India by translating the Anguttara Nikaya, or Book of the Numerical Sayings, into Hindi, and was now engaged in translating the entire Jataka book. Thus, Badant Anand Kausalyayanan, politician, Buddhist monk, journalist and translator, champion of the national language and scourge of Hindu reactionaries, was a complex figure and as such difficult of comprehension. Though he once had told me that it was his ambition to be known as the Voltaire of India, there seemed to be no master principle, no dominant theme, no overriding motive, no Jiban Debata, or life god in Tagore's language, which could be regarded as reconciling the different, even contradictory sides of his character, and giving unity of purpose to his various activities. He was certainly not aiming at the attainment of enlightenment in this life, but neither was he wholly bent on professional success, whether political, journalistic, or even religious. There were occasions when I thought he did not really believe in anything, and simply wanted to pass the time in as amusing a fashion as possible, even if this meant his having to stir up a hornet's nest or two. Because I found RNG difficult to comprehend, I was not always sure how I should conduct myself towards him. I could hardly treat him as my monastic superior in the real sense, with all that this involved in the way of receptivity on my part and responsibility on his. Indeed, it was not always easy for me to regard him as a Buddhist. At the same time, there was no question of my being able to treat him simply as a politician or a progressive journalist, or even as an ordinary fellow monk. I therefore compromised, outwardly showing him all the formal respect and deference due to a senior member of the order, but inwardly keeping my thoughts to myself, except when circumstances obliged me to reveal them by my actions, as had been the case that Sunday afternoon at the Dharmadaya Vihara, when I had glimpsed the unacceptable face of communism. End of chapter 14.